You have great tits. They're really beautiful. I like nice tits. I always have. How about you?
I like having nice tits.
You like to show them off.
I didn't like showing them off the cheetah.
Why not? I like looking at them there. Everybody liked looking at them there.
Made me feel like a hooker.
You are a whore, darling.
No, I'm not.
We all are. We take the cash, we cash the check, we show them what they want to see.
It's been 25 years since Showgirls hit movie theaters to a confused and terrified public. Promoted as All About Eve in a G-string, the movie is a demented roller coaster ride through the eyes of Nomi Malone, an ambitious dancer who screams, slams, and screws her way to the top of a Las Vegas showgirl review. Goddess. Like Paul Verhoeven's previous film, Basic Instinct, Showgirls was supposed to be a star vehicle for Elizabeth Berkley. Instead, the Saved by the Bell actress spent the rest of her career wrestling with the trauma of being labeled the worst actress in the worst film in Hollywood history.
Today, documentary filmmaker Jeffrey McHale joins us to take a look at why people still can't stop talking about Showgirls all these years later. Jeffrey's feature film debut, You Don't Know Me, explores the themes of sexual violence, camp, and outrageousness in Paul Verhoeven's films, and interviews a wide variety of fans of this cult classic, including our dear friend Peaches Christ. Listen as we take a look at how Showgirls inspired early drag characters on social media like Human Resources Irene and Crystal Connors, and how it was the bedrock of many of the great moments in Feast of Fun's own history. Darling.
You think you can do my nails for me now, sugar?
Sure, why not?
On a second thought, I'm a little too old for that hoary look.
You're never too old for that hoary look.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Before we begin, let's listen to a clip of Elizabeth Berkley on David Letterman promoting Showgirls before critics and moviegoers got to see it. Elizabeth was so excited about the role, she offered to give David Letterman a lap dance.
Well, now, technically speaking, what is a lap dance? Is it legal in most states?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Really? Well, what is it exactly?
Well, I would do it for you, but your censors would have me thrown off the show. So I'll just tell you that basically it's about seduction.
Uh-huh.
And the woman basically, and it's about power, and the woman basically is being paid to seduce and to
you
turn
just
the
sit
man
on. You sit on my lap. Is that what it is?
Yeah, well, let me just show you one thing.
Okay. What should I do?
You just stay there. You just relax. But I'm
okay.
Just going to say, I'm not going to show you the whole thing because these are things you have to see in the movie, but this is the basic position.
That's enough right there! Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
We'll stop right there because...
Hey!
Hi, is this Jeffrey McHale?
This is he.
Hi, Jeffrey. It's Mark and Fausto from Feast of Fun. How are you?
Great, guys. How are you?
Doing great. I am a big fan of the movie Showgirls, and I've been anticipating your documentary film, You Don't Know Me. I know that you've been working and writing about this film for a long time, and I have to say, it must be weird now not having them all come over you like that.
Well, yeah, you know, I miss that. You know, I miss that. It's not the same anymore.
Jeffrey, you saw this film at a film festival in 2005. You say it changed your life forever.
It did. I was actually, you know, I think it was the Cinespia screening in 2015. So it was actually the end of the film. Mm-hmm. You Don't Know Me. We have Elizabeth Berkley, you know, introducing the film to a crowd of 4,000 people. And I was actually one of those 4,000 people.
Oh.
So we, you know, living in LA, you know, we go to those screenings, you know, every summer. And sometimes because it's LA and because most people live here, if someone wants to participate or someone wants to say a few words, who was in the film, they might join the event. But I don't think any of us ever expected, you know, Miss Nomi Malone would be there in person. And it was just amazing. It was, yeah.
I can imagine the crowd just kind of went wild, like, because it was a surprise to everyone, right?
Oh yeah, I mean it was a complete surprise. I mean the guy introduced the film. He comes out there and you know kind of gives his introduction, and then he says, and I think you know I have somebody here who from the film who wants to say a few words, and you know there was just audible gasps, you know, and people were like what, and then all there was like this delay until when she walked out, until when she stepped in front of the camera where she was projected on the wall too. And so there was this slow, gradual, like audible gasp that gradually made its way to the back where we were. And it was just incredible. I mean, yeah, she said something that really stuck with me that night was this was the first time in 20 years that she was going to experience the film with a crowd that embraced it.
What a gag.
It's insane. You know, it was insane. Like,
and part of it is like for people who are not familiar with the film Showgirls, it's Paul Verhoeven's most controversial film, even though he's made equally outrageous films that certainly put sexual violence, fantasy, sexuality, the exploitation of people front and center. And and this film, above all his other films, really at the time was rejected very viscerally by the press and the general public. In preparing for this interview, like I went online and watched Elizabeth Berkley having a conversation about the film with David Letterman, who had not seen the film. And she's like doing lap dances for him. So, you know, like Elizabeth Berkley really anticipated that the public was going to embrace her as this very mature actress. And she was shedding off Jesse Spano from Saved by the Bell. And then the film came out and the public went, what the hell? With Roger Ebert. And this is somebody who wrote the film Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. So Roger Ebert is no stranger to camp, to the over-the-top sexuality and nudity and hijinks of the film Showgirls. He rejected it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, everybody at that time rejected it, you know? I mean, but then look at who the critics were. I mean, they were all mostly white, straight men, you know, who were reviewing films at the time. But yeah, I mean, I think it also, just looking at coming off of Basic Instinct and what that movie did for Sharon Stone, you know, one of my contributors, David Schmader, said something that, you know, it's so true that, you know, when you watch Basic Instinct, it was like you're watching almost like the birth of a movie star, you know, in front of your eyes. And Sharon Stone had been in other films, you know, before that, but that role like solidified her.
I heard that she didn't know that the leg crossing scene was being filmed from the angle of her vagina and she was furious about it.
Yeah, she felt deceived. He basically said, oh, you know, we need you to take off your underwear for the shot or something like that, you know, to that extent.
But didn't she get suspicious when he put the camera right there on the floor?
Well, you know, I mean, back in the day, I mean, I don't think those what was it called? You know, those monitors on set, they probably weren't as good as they are now, you know. But, you know, and I do think she even said, like, he deceived me to do that, but you know, he made the right decision for the role, you know, for the movie. It was the right choice.
So you were saying this Basic Instinct was a star maker vehicle for her.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
For Sharon Stone.
So you think Elizabeth Berkley was thinking this was going to be the same kind of model?
Oh, I mean, yeah. Just reading the script. I mean, she's in every scene of the movie. I mean, it's she is the movie. You know, Nomi Malone is Showgirls. And
don't you think she would have gotten a little suspicious though reading that script? Because like every scene she's in, she yells at somebody and then slams the door on her way out.
This is my friend Nomi. She's a dancer too.
Is she now?
Yes, and she's really good.
What do you dance at, darling?
At the Cheetah.
I don't know how good you are, darling. And I don't know what it is you're good at. But if it's at the Cheetah, it's not dancing, I know that much.
You don't know shit!
You know, the stage direction.
Yeah, the stage direction.
Nomi exits the scene angrily.
Violently, yeah. She read the script and wanted, I mean, she even mentioned that night at Cinespia there, you know, she said she read the script. She, you know, called producers. She got herself an audition. She, you know, really, really saw that, that was really something that was, important to her. She thought it would be a great character to take. They wanted to be a part of the movie and she made it happen.
Now, the critics, when this came out, it was universally panned, mostly, like you said, by straight white men. I think, you know, with the revelations around Harvey Weinstein and the whole Me Too movement, do you feel like the show would have received a different kind of reception nowadays?
Yeah, I don't think a movie like this probably would be made. You know, what some people said, what, it was the death of that genre of film, you know, that kind of erotic thriller, you know, that Showgirls kind of killed that genre. And, you know, I think that a lot of the sex and nudity that, you know, once you had to go to movies to see, now, you know, it's on HBO, it's on TV. I mean, that's where, you know, people are pushing boundaries with as far as sexuality goes, you know.
Well, that's the thing about, you know, campy films, is that when filmmakers have gone out to make or capture that lightning in a bottle again, it doesn't come across as successful because they're aware of the double entendres. They become, you know, and there's a certain naive quality to the film Showgirls. And I think, like, you know, it's interesting to see the dynamics between Gina Gershon, who plays Crystal Connors, and Kyle MacLachlan, who plays the show's producer. That, you know, most of the actors and that we've interviewed here on the podcast have all said, we knew this was something really strange, but we decided to go along with Paul's direction. Gina Gershon says, I was in on the joke. Kyle MacLachlan, Patrick Bristow, they all felt like it was a strange project, but they didn't realize how strange it would be when it finally hit the screens. Do you think everybody was in on the joke except Elizabeth Berkley? I just don't buy that.
It's so hard to say. You know, I think that, you know, obviously Gina gets, you know, is perceived as being, you know, having some level of awareness to the role and the part. And I think, you know, she does play that character, Crystal Connors, with more of a wink and a nod.
Anybody here?
Back here.
What are you doing here?
What am I doing here?
I'm doing some of the finest cocaine in the world, darling. You want some?
It's great for the muscles.
But I think with her and Kyle, you know, they also had other films and other roles, and, you know, they had a whole other career to kind of fall back on, you know. So I think that when Elizabeth Berkley, you know, this was her first major film role outside of Saved by the Bell, and so people were less forgiving, maybe. But and it's hard to kind of figure out, like, oh, you know, what was, you know, what was the understanding? What was the intent? I mean, that's part of the allure of Showgirls, is what was everybody thinking? But kind of going back and looking at the way that the people involved have talked about the film and, you know, defended the film or explained the film, you know, in the last 20, 25 years, their answers kind of waver, you know, like it just kind of, they're fit to kind of the conversation that we're having about it now. So one of the interesting things about Nomi was, you know, this isn't a traditional behind the scenes making of story of Showgirls. This is how we as the audience have, you know, lived with it, how, you know, our relationship to it continues to evolve and how we're not done with it. And so that was kind of where I thought, you know, where I wanted to kind of focus the conversation.
And so when you say the film changed your life, what was the most profound change you saw?
I mean, just as far as what, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't be having conversations like this. You know, I mean, this was my first film, you know. I grew up making movies, made my own films, and, you know, kind of transitioned into television editing after college, and kind of put away, you know, put my kind of aspirations of filmmaking aside, you know, and just said, okay, you know, I'll be good editing TV and whatnot. And I just thought that after that screening, I thought this was the perfect kind of subject that, you know, was worthy of exploration. And I knew it was something that I could do on my own. And that was one of the interesting things, is, you know, I made this movie from my kitchen table, from my laptop.
That's really impressive. Have you ever been to Las Vegas beforehand?
I actually had, yeah. Me and my husband, when we moved from Chicago to LA, we did the road trip, and we had one night in Vegas, and it was, yeah, it was just insane. I got way too drunk.
Did you go to Spago and drink Crystal?
we stayed at the Riviera, actually. But we went to the one gay bar. on the strip. I can't remember the name of it.
Did you shop at Versace?
No, we didn't. We didn't. We weren't there long enough. Yeah. Aubrey O'Day made an appearance that night at the whatever club we were at. There was an incident with a mouse on our car when we were trying to check in the hotel. It was a very like traumatic, intense 18 hours. And then, you know, we spent the next eight hours on the way to Los Angeles, you know, massively hungover.
The funny thing about, you know, Showgirls is that it's a love letter to the city of Las Vegas and in all its complexities and exploitation. One thing that I feel like the film didn't capture is all the like people standing on the sidewalk going, you know, flicking cards at you to go see their stripper shows.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's still happening, but when Mark and I first started going to Las Vegas, it was for podcasting conventions. And for us, the film Showgirls is intertwined with the history of podcasting and our interviews with the cast and connoisseurs of the film like Peaches Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, it was something that like, you know, bonded us and brought us all together into this kind of weird community of fans of this film.
You fuck him for the spot or you fuck him because you wanted to? I say you did it for the spot.
Is that what you did, Crystal?
You don't want to piss me off, darling, now that we're friends.
No, you shouldn't get pissed off. It makes you look older.
In so much that before there was, you know, DragCon, we talked about with Peaches Christ about organizing Goddess Con.
Oh my God.
It was a conference of fans of the film Showgirls, because at that time, until Elizabeth Berkley started embracing it, a lot of people were just like really kind of fascinated it. Uh-huh. And one of the earliest things, one of the memes, one of the biggest, weirdest things was this fake Facebook account called Human Resources Irene, which was status updates from the perspective of Irene. She's the actress who goes, deceased?
Uh-huh. Oh, I know.
I'll take it to personnel. They want some information.
What kind of information?
Date of birth.
7-3-73.
Place of birth.
New York.
New York, New York?
Yeah.
Nearest family members.
I don't have any family.
Deceased?
So in the early days of Facebook, you could become friends with Human Resources Irene. And she's like talking about all the human resources violations that take place at the Stardust Hotel. Yeah.
At one point in time, there was a Nomi Malone on Facebook, a Crystal Connors, and Human Molly. Resources Irene. And I think we knew at least one of the people that did Crystal Connors, right?
Yeah.
I think that was Jim Nash, right?
Yep, Jim Nash,
and
the comedian.
And then I think somebody else came forward and said that they were Human Resources Irene. But
I think that's amazing.
Human Resources Irene on Facebook gave birth to a lot of office workers. Drag queens. I'm pretty sure Karen from finance probably came from that kind of same world.
And that's the thing about like the film Showgirls. You know, it's this outrageous $1 million big box disaster that had a second life at a time when we as a society felt that we were very savvy and cynical to some degree, that it was impossible to create another Rocky Horror Picture Show kind of phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with Peaches Christ, you know, for 20 years after this film was made, pretty much shortly afterwards, and certainly Misunderstood in New York City also was doing similar things. Mm-hmm. They were doing campy midnight showings of Showgirls to sold out crowds. And Peaches developed her cult audience based on the San Francisco reaction to it. In fact, I would argue, I don't know if you've ever seen a lot of Peaches' shows, but her production of Showgirls, I would argue, is one of her best works as a playwright. And it's stands on its own because it doesn't rely on the celebrity of the guests to carry the public passion for this spectacle.
Well, Faust is trying to say you don't need a girl from RuPaul's Drag Race to come and sell the tickets.
The show stands on its own.
It's hard to pack a theater, you know? Like the Castro Theater is a huge space. And for Peaches, it's like, she's been very successful in getting the public excited about interviews with, you know, celebrities and artists and collaborating with these personalities. But Showgirls for Peaches Christ is this weird, wonderful, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity where it was her and her friends from college – recreating and putting on this film and coming up with lines like, what is it? You like doggy chow too? Wet or dry?
It's so good. Yeah. And in that she finds, you know, they always do, you know, the, what she said, like the entrance, you know, is always the same. And then they'll find various scenes to do, you know, for each of their shows. So he's like, over the 20 years, you know, we probably have done the whole movie.
When you first saw the film Showgirls, I imagine that you wanted to watch it again and again and again, because it was something that really made you laugh and was this kind of guilty pleasure.
Absolutely. I mean, it was one of those, you know, I was probably a little too sheltered when it first came out to see it. And I don't know why it took me so long. Maybe it was just the ad campaign, or, you know, I didn't think it was for me. And then, you know, after moving to Chicago, I saw it with a friend. We were hanging out one night in his apartment, and Showgirls came up, and he found out I never saw it, and he like walked over to his DVD shelf and popped it in the TV, and you know, it's pure magic. I mean, within the first few minutes, you're just like, oh my god, is this really the movie? And then you just don't want it to end. And I mean, I mean everyone I talked to kind of had very similar kind of experience with it, where someone, you know, you were shown by somebody. And I feel like that is you know, one of the great things about camp films is you know, it's exposing, you know, friends and like-minded people to it.
Without a doubt, it can be life-changing.
Exactly.
We showed it to a young man once. It was this guy named Peter, and I saw it. I'll tell you this little story. So I'm on the train coming home one day, and I see this guy sitting across from me, and he looks like a male version of Elizabeth Berkley. Young, probably like 18, 19 years old. Big, giant, like chipmunk cheeks, chiseled jaws, big giant brown eyes and blonde hair. And he gets off at the same stop that I get off at. And I'm just like, oh, okay. So then he's going like the same direction I'm going. And I'm like, oh, well, is he going to turn left or right up here? And I said, well, if he turns right, I'll follow him and I'll just go home. If he turns left, I'll follow him and go to Clark's on Clark, the bar. So he turns left, and then I'm just kind of like following him. And I'm like, well, I'm going to go to the bar because I'm coming home after work, after bartending. And then he kind of made eyes at me on the train. And then he comes like to his courtyard building, and he kind of enters the courtyard, but then slings back and is hanging off the pole, and he's like, have a good night. And I'm just kind of like shocked that he says this. And I'm just like, yeah, you have a good night too. And he's just like, and then he kind of like scurries away, and I go off to the bar, and I tell Fausto, I'm like, oh my God, I met this guy. He looked like Nomi Malone. You know, at this point in time, I don't know what the deal is with him.
I was waiting for him to pull a knife on you.
Yeah. And so then we're at this restaurant, and he ends up being our waiter. It was like a pancake house or something like that. And Fausto was having a birthday party. He's just like, hey, why don't you come to our party? And he goes, okay. You know, so he comes to the party, and it's all a bunch of queens, right? He walks in, and I'm like, you guys, everyone, Nomi Malone. And they're like, oh my God, he looks like Nomi Malone. So we sat him down at this party and put him in front of the TV, and he watched Showgirls pretty much by himself because everybody else had already seen it. And then he was just like, that movie was incredible. So guess what he does? He ends up becoming a stripper and moves to Vegas.
Oh my
God. And I never heard from him again.
Well, the path of him was, he felt that Peter felt that this film really connected with him. Mm-hmm. And so he got into bodybuilding, and naturally, as a consequence, he got into stripping, dancing at clubs. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of that, he started doing private lap dances. His life mirrored the fictional life of the character of Nomi Malone. And just like in the sense that when he moved to Las Vegas, he had a lot of interpersonal problems, so did Peter as well. Mm-hmm. And we ran into him like several years later after all that stuff. And he's like, you know, that movie really kind of messed me up to some degree, you know? And I felt really bad because, you know, in a lot of ways, as us, as LGBTQ people, we have this kind of language to navigate intense films like this one. But I think, you know, for Peter, I think he mostly identifies as heterosexual. But just like kind of Elizabeth Berkley, he's somebody who's craving a lot of attention. And so his sexuality then becomes something for him to negotiate with, right? So in the film Showgirls, Nomi Malone pretty much has sex or flirts with everybody, right? And in this case, you know, Peter's sexuality was up for grabs. And mm-hmm. I hope that he's in a better place mm-hmm. now. Like, mm-hmm. we lost complete touch with this guy. But he for a
probably
while,
in
he
Los
was
Angeles
a,
now.
A major dancer in the Chicago gay nightclub scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, not many people have a story like that. But
well, these cult films, they affect people different ways, you know. And yeah. I hopefully if Peter's out there and he's listening to this, let us know. And hopefully it all turned out OK for you. I mean, because we're going back to, I mean, this is
25 years,
this
30
is
not, years.
This is this is 2000. Well,
yeah, because it's the 25 year anniversary of Showgirls.
Yeah.
So, Jeffrey, today, like, in terms of the impact and the influence that this film has had on filmmakers and portraying sexuality in films, what do you make of it? Like, has Showgirls influenced anybody except, you know, us and you and Peaches Christ? Random strippers or...
I think there's you can probably pull out threads and references, you know, in a lot of films and in TV shows and in characters. But yeah, I think one of the real interesting things is just, you know, the LGBTQ community. I mean, queer people and the way that we connect with it and we use it the way that we connect with each other and, you know, the lines and just the references, it just becomes part of our lexicon. And, you know, it's this thing that we love. And, so I think that's where like kind of the beauty of it lies, you know.
What I really loved about your film too, is how you, showed Showgirls in the milieu of Verhoeven's work. Like, you can't really look at Showgirls just on its own, because, to understand the film, you also have to see some of his other films. And he had a lot of like reoccurring themes. Almost sometimes it seemed like scenes where the same scene from another movie was in this kind of thing. It almost as though he's kind of telling the same story, but in different kinds of ways over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of his films, I mean, he repeats, you know, motifs and themes and, you know, kind of tropes. And just when I started the project, I, you know, after reading, you know, everything that had been kind of written about Showgirls, I just for my own curiosity, was like, all right, well, I should watch all of Paul's early films. I mean, I had seen his American films. I mean, that's how, you know, we know Paul Verhoeven is, you know, Total Recall, RoboCop, you know, Starship Troopers, and I mean these sci-fi blockbusters. And so for most people, I think Showgirls doesn't really make sense, you know, when you look at, you know, his American films. Mm-hmm. But once I started to go back and watch all of his early films, I mean, it was just amazing to see these threads and these motifs and these weird little moments that, you know, you can't really explain in Showgirls that have roots in his early careers. And I wanted to find a way to connect Showgirls with the rest of his films and to do that visually and make like a new subplot where, you know, the Verhoeven characters in his other films or their experiences are interacting with, you know, the contributors in Nomi and with Showgirls too. So mm-hmm. it was just seeing these, you know, the chips and the nails and consumption of dog food and like people vomiting all over the place. I mean, it was just, I basically had every film loaded into my editing system and I would just drop a marker every time, you know, and I would put like nails, vomit, you know, anytime something, cause it was after watching like the first two, I'm like, oh, okay. Like there's a, like something's going on here. And, you know, it just, I wanted to find a way to like kind of keep track of it all.
Sure. It certainly gave me a lot of different perspective on it, especially with like Total Recall. It's now I see, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger is kind of basically Nomi Malone in space, right?
Yeah.
Supposed That's to buy amazing. Into the evil yeah. system, but is going to fight yeah. against it.
Uh-huh.
I was surprised that Paul Verhoeven actually had another weird sex pool scene in another movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark and I have actually tried to recreate that ourselves.
Foster hurt his back.
But you can't do that scene without somebody underneath you holding you up.
Unless you're trained.
I don't think, I think, you know, when they actually filmed that, there was probably somebody in scuba gear underneath the Elizabeth Berkeley holding her up so she could flap around the pool like that. Or there was a chair or some kind of... there was certainly something technical about filming it in that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's a repetition of the lap dance scene too, you know, mirroring of that. And there, you know, was clearly, no one holding her up, or I mean, maybe there was.
Well, I mean, you and your husband, like when you get into a swimming pool, do you guys like look at each other and like, don't think about it?
Don't. No. I mean, it's hilarious. I mean, you make jokes all the time. It's hard not to, but, yeah. And then just to see those other, similar moves and, you know, he just has, you could just tell like the way he directs the his actors and the characters and, yeah, in Flesh and Blood, there was a very similar kind of, bathtub pool scene. And it's just kind of mind blowing.
You talk about in the documentary that Showgirls, concludes this camp trilogy of, Valley of the Dolls, Mommy Dearest, and Showgirls, you know, film critic and, you know, gay icon Michael Musto, he describes it as a Valley of the Dolls beyond the Valley of the Dolls and Showgirls. Why to you, like, is the film Mommy Dearest so critical in grouping it with these other films?
Well, I can't take credit for that. So that was Jeffrey Conway, who wrote this book of poems called Showgirls, the Movie in Sistina's. And I mean, it is an incredible breakdown. He basically takes the title of every chapter in the DVD and finds different ways to inhibit the story, the movie, the characters. And so for one of the chapters, I mean, he kind of hailed the trilogy of camp complete and basically saying that, you know, these three films were, after seeing Showgirls, I mean, he felt like that the trilogy was complete. So after, you know, loving Valley of the Dolls and loving, you know, Mommy Dearest for those years. And the interesting thing about those three films is they're all 14 years apart too. So they're kind of evenly spaced.
Oh, really?
And, you know, they are. Yeah. That's amazing. Which is weird.
Well, part of it, like what they share in common is about the toxicity of American culture and rugged individualism that pits people against the world and uses fame and the success of fame and the insatiable quest thirst for that in bringing up a lot of moral depravity, right? So in terms of Valley of the Dolls, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is very similar films of, you know, these starlets. I think Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is mostly about musicians than it is actors. And then, you know, Mommy Dearest is certainly, you know, focuses on the life of Joan Crawford, which to me, that's why I feel like it doesn't really dovetail very well with the other two films.
But the other films were kind of like, you know, meant to be serious kind of films, right? But they ended up being, all of them ended up being camp classics.
Well, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls was a Russ Meyer film.
So that was intentional exploitive, right?
And it was meant to be exploitive. It was meant to be wild and crazy. And it was even more outrageous than they even anticipated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think that, it's just the look at the way that those films also were treated amongst the press and the way that their stars were treated, too. I mean, you can see, you know, a common threads that run through the reception of those films and then the eventual, like, embrace, you know, by the queer community, too. So
Rena Riffles had a hard time. She of all the actors in the film, she plays Penny Hope. Nobody wants to fuck a Penny, want to fuck a Hope, right? Is he serious? Rena Riffle, she for a long time was embracing the film. She was very involved with Peaches Christ and her productions, and she even put out an album of songs inspired by a character that she created from the film Trasherella. And then she did a sequel, Showgirls 2, Pennies from Heaven.
Pennies from Heaven. Yep.
And you know, the films are not, you know, they're really just kind of home movie quality kind of things going on there. Then Rena Riffle for a while had a really, I guess she fell in love with somebody and she decided she didn't want to be associated with the film anymore. So she like abruptly cut off all relationships that she had. And now she's kind of going back and forth with it. Is this kind of like dance the actors have with this film and embracing it is really kind of a dance that Hollywood has with just human sexuality in general?
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, who knows what, you know, what that experience was like for, you know, those people involved and how it affected their career. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, there's a lot of there's pain there, you know, in some aspect of that experience. So, you know, I don't put too much blame or, you know, emphasis on, you know, kind of this wavering kind of support over the film, because yeah, it's hard to, I'm sure it was a hard experience, hard thing to, you know, to go through for everybody.
Gina Gershon had committed to doing a Broadway musical version of Showgirls before the actual Showgirls musical was staged.
Oh, wow. I did not hear that.
Yeah, in an interview, you know, they were like...
She said she would do it.
She would
like in an interview, they were like, would you do it? I was like...
I'm sure they would all come back for a sequel, wouldn't they?
Oh, I don't know about that. I don't think so.
I mean, Elizabeth just seemed absolutely crushed by it. Are you kind of surprised that she wasn't able to kind of like muster through? I mean, so many other people have had some real bombs in their career. Like, you know, Sally Field was in The Flying Nun and she was able to like go beyond that. You know, so many people.
And I think that's what, like, you know, as fans, that's what you want. I mean, you want there to be some, you know, acknowledgement, or you want there to be, you know, kind of like a piece and to know that how much this movie and this role and that character, you know, means to so many people. And so I think that's why that moment, you know, at the Cinespia was just so incredible for all of us, you know, because yeah, you just want those involved to just to know how much it means and to just enjoy in this afterlife and the embrace and because yeah, they deserve it.
How disappointed were you in Dancing with the Stars that Elizabeth Berkley would choose the Save for the Bell moment to
Saved
dance
by the Bell.
Save by the Bell moment to dance to and not touch on Showgirls at all?
That was pretty disappointing. But you know, at least it shows, you know, there is some, you know, she's having fun with some of those roles, and who knows, maybe there was some stuff with ABC, you know, as to why they couldn't do certain things. But but yeah, I mean, I love the I'm so excited. I mean, that was just amazing. jazz pills or whatever, jive pills.
Yeah. We interviewed the guy who came up with Save with the by the Bell. He wrote it, right? Yeah. Is that what it was? He
oh,
came
really?
Up with it. Yeah, he's like 80 some years old now, and he's he was really surprised by Showgirls when it came out.
Yeah, I'm sure. For sure.
Lynn Tucci, who plays Henrietta Bazooms.
You're a fucking stripper, don't you get it?
I'm a dancer.
You're a dancer? Then Henry here is the fucking Virgin Mary.
I got bigger tits than the fucking Virgin Mary, and I got a bigger mouth, too. My
hair. Hey, goddammit, you're the only one who could get my tits popping right.
I have to piss on you to give you a clue. She got a second career on Orange is the New Black.
Orange is the New Black. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. All the actors, I mean, they've all gone on to do other things. You know, I mean, even Paul Verhoeven. I mean, he has a Golden Globe now, a Golden Globe winning film. And, you know, he's still making films over in Europe. But yeah, you know, it's...
Did he never make another American film after that, right?
He did. Yeah. He had Starship Troopers was already kind of in the works. And then Hollow Man was the last Hollywood film for.
And for people not familiar, Hollow Man is Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon's like Invisible Man.
As the Invisible Man, but the becoming the Invisible Man makes him into a, once again, homicidal killer rapist monster.
Yeah, yeah. Which is funny because Paul had given an interview, I forget when, maybe it was 10 or so years after Showgirls, but he basically said something to the extent of Showgirls would have been succeeded or been better received had there been a serial killer in it.
Oh, I would definitely think, you know, the Hays Code influenced Hollywood still to this day, that where in the past you could show, you know, sexual... topics or innuendo, and as long as you had a punishment for that. In fact, the character of Dr. Frankenfurter's death is very important in the mainstreaming, you know, and Rocky Horror Picture Show, actually, a lot of people don't know, was actually a commercially successful film, and actually greenlit this independent film made by a young college student, George Lucas. Star Wars would not have been made had Rocky Horror Picture Show not been as successful as it was. And in fact, a lot of the conventionalists from the Transylvanian conference, right? The unconventional conventions, especially that tall guy who eats the cake in that scene. Mm-hmm. He was a stand-in for Chewbacca in the first Star Wars film.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
And the casting agency is called the Ugly Agency.
They're still in existence in the UK. Yeah, you can get a job there.
I'll have to send them my resume.
They just need a photo.
Now, Elizabeth Berkley, in attempts to wrestle with the complicated relationship that Hollywood has with feminism and sexuality, she came out with a book a while back called Ask. What was it? It was Ask Elizabeth, where she was giving real answers to everything you secretly wanted to know about love, friends, your body, and life in general. And she started like a nonprofit foundation for...
Aww.
For young women. What happened to all that?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, she's a vegan. I know she kind of promotes that lifestyle too. And not sure what's going on with the nonprofit, but we didn't reach out and didn't talk to any of the cast and crew. So, you know, I don't know.
Well, that was around the time period where every celebrity started, probably really doing their own nonprofit charity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people started going like, is this a tax write-off? Or, like, are you really sincerely interested in helping other people? I'm, like, you know, I'm sorry that
children's books too
become something bigger, for sure.
Yeah, and everyone was writing children's books.
In terms of, you know, like, the impact of making this film, you didn't use any actual captured footage. All you did was kind of podcast, right? You interviewed people and you edited existing clips to make the film.
Exactly. So I had a conversation similarly to the way that we're talking now. I had an audio kit that I would mail each contributor, and we would log on to Skype, and, you know, we could see each other, you know, through the computer, but, and we would just chat for, you know, 90 minutes, 2 hours about Showgirls. I had certain points I wanted each person to hit and to discuss. And then after the interview was done, they boxed it up and shipped it back to me. So, I did that for about 9 months and then started just kind of transcribing all the interviews and scripting everything and trying to get a good layout and kind of, I first started kind of scene by scene and thought by thought, editing wise and just using Showgirls. And then once I started to kind of, start doing some more archival stuff and looking at some of the news reports and interviews given at the time. And then, you know, once I started watching all of Paul Verhoeven's films, I mean, then it just kind of opened up this other, this whole other world that, you know, I wanted to kind of explore.
And who had the biggest difficulty using basically recording their voice? Was it Peaches or Paul Verhoeven?
Well, no, Peaches was a pro.
Of course she was.
Yeah, no, she was great. There were no technical issues. There were no technical issues. It was just a very nerve-wracking two and a half days, you know, of waiting for the kit to come back, because that was where the master audio was on their end. And so I was just like, God, I hope everything is arrived safely. I mean, it always did.
Well, the early days of podcasting, the director of Battlestar Galactica had his own podcast where he would just record himself into a portable audio recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it? Braga? Anyways, I'll Google it later and insert it. Mark, can you type and search? So anyways, he would do this podcast and he would Ronald Moore would sit in his living room drinking some scotch and reflect on each episode of Battlestar Galactica. And instead of uploading the audio up into the internet, he would put that in a FedEx package, send it to his assistant in Los Angeles, and they would upload it to the internet. And we were sitting at a conference in Las Vegas, of all places, where he was talking about this.
To a group of podcasters.
And everybody gasped, thinking, how inefficient is this? But in hindsight, you know, a lot of people do have a hard time, like, uploading large files to the internet to this day. And so it makes sense to sort of having somebody send all that equipment back to you.
Yeah. I mean, I gave him, basically just box it back up in the box it came with. There was a pre-printed FedEx label. So I tried to make it as easy, and not ask as many favors as I try to cut down on the favors I was asking of them, to help get me my stuff back. But I mean, everyone was great.
Well, certainly, you know, we very much enjoyed watching the movie, and certainly it's, I feel like we left with even more questions than answers still 25 years later with Showgirls. And, you know, there are so many things that happen in that film. As Peaches Christ describes it, she says it's a very efficient film in the twists and turns that it goes through, that where there's just always something happening every single moment of the film up until the very end, where it sort of mirrors itself. And, you know, Nomi Malone is kind of almost like a malevolent force, if you would describe it, right? Because she leaves Las Vegas in ruins, and now she's descending on Hollywood.
She's heading to Hollywood. Yeah, I know. Yeah, you could just... Yeah, you don't even need to write the sequel. You can just imagine it.
Well, that's what makes the ending so satisfying, is that you have this ending that where your imagination just runs wild.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you have an idea, a theory of where you think what she does in L.A.?
Well, you know, what does she say? She married the nephew of one of the richest designers in the world, probably. She probably became a vegetarian. She ditched the burgers. What else?
Is this real life Elizabeth Berkeley stuff?
Yeah.
Who did she marry?
Ralph Lauren's nephew, Greg, I think. Yeah.
Well, it seems like Elizabeth Berkeley did like brown rice and vegetables after all.
She did. She did, even though she craved that burger, fries, and soda. And we were just watching it again the other night. It was just like, what? Who orders that during the middle of a rehearsal?
And she probably hasn't touched dog food in years.
She's like, I'll have a can of Alpo, a bacon double cheeseburger, some cheese fries, and a big gulp of Dr. Pepper.
Yeah, and 5, 6, 7, 8.
What? I was like, no wonder she's vomiting throughout this movie.
Yeah.
There's a puppet comedy company ensemble called Harvey Finkelstein, who actually performed in the early Feast of Fools shows with us here in Chicago, and fringe festival sensation called Sock Puppet Showgirls.
I heard about this. Yeah, I could never find it. I heard and read a couple articles that referenced it, and I tried to find more about it, but I was never able to kind of to put the pieces together.
More happy to introduce you to them. They're still doing stuff. And
oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just interesting. It's how many different things it spawned and created, and, you know, musicals and poems and sock puppets, and, you know, someone just released a coloring book of Showgirls.
Oh, really? So it has like Elizabeth Berkeley like thrusting it, and Marty Jacobson, Patrick Bristow screaming at her.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know that activity coloring Patrick book. Said he a lot of his lines in the film actually he improvised them. Because
I think
his
mother heard an interview with him.
Was a choreographer. And so the do a PK turn, Nomi, is something that he inserted in.
Because the script called for something else. And he's like, they wouldn't say this. And yeah. Like, well, what would they say? He's like, do a PK turn. So you're like, okay.
Sure, it works. Doesn't matter.
He's one of
the
people that kind of says they had an idea things were getting a little weird, because that whole thrust it thing, it was just like, he said he was doing it. And Verhoeven was just like, more. More. Yeah. And so then he's just like, I'm just going to go crazy over the top and do it more. And then I did it like that. And he's just like, okay, that's it. And he's just like, no way. I think that, you know,
I heard a story where he didn't.
The actors, they talk about how, like, some of them, like Kyle MacLachlan, like you mentioned, or they mentioned in your film, this idea that they just did it as a full on drama. I think that they probably had that in their mind, but every now and then they got like a little inkling or like, this is weird. Or that, and so, and now in retrospect, that maybe that little tiny moment stands out more for them now than it originally did.
Yeah, and who knows how many other takes they did, or, you know, how varied each performance was, you know, and then, you know, maybe just in the edit, it got crazier and crazier.
Now, another thing that people don't realize about Showgirls, and I wonder if you picked up on this, it's a Christmas movie.
It is. It is. We put out a video highlighting all the Christmas references in Showgirls this year.
In the beginning, though, it starts off in Halloween. I guess there's kids trick-or-treating in the background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it tracks some of the holiday. Yeah, like who? What trick-or-treaters are going to kids? Their parents are going to let their kids off on the you know Vegas strip to trick-or-treat.
That candy like, is amazing. I'll tell you that. But don't inhale the ones that look like little glass vials you snap.
Yeah. But they skip over Thanksgiving. We don't ever get a Thanksgiving moment.
I wonder if that was just left in the cutting room floor.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Maybe it was Thanksgiving when they were having
their doggy child. Well, Nomi is stuffed with a tampon at one point in time.
She's not actually. That's why she was, I got towels, baby.
Yeah.
She said she had towels. A tampon and you could feel it. And so he sticks his hands down her pants.
No, she's having her period and then he sticks it and he pulls out and his fingers are wet and he smells them. James Smith.
Yeah.
You got too much talent for it to be right.
So she didn't have a tampon in there?
I don't think so. Jeffrey, can you clarify that?
No, I think there was a no tampon. I think that was what was being said. Yes.
She was. That's why he says, I got towels, baby.
Well, she's having my period. You can stick your hand down there and feel it or something. I don't know.
Well, you're so adamant about it. So.
Well, I mean, that's how I remember it.
Revisionist history. James Smith, you know, a lot of these actors also lived on in Law and Order, Orange is the New Black, and you know, I guess I'm wondering, you know, have we grown? Are we better as a society? Like, can we embrace sexuality in a healthier way? And maybe this film might not get made because we just would look at something like this and say, you know, this is glorifying violence against women and. You know, it's just not something as a society we want to see anymore.
Yeah, I think that that question kind of comes up a lot is, you know, have we learned anything? Have we, you know, would this get made again? I don't think it would get this movie like this would get made, you know, if it were, you know, they probably have a, you know, female director attached to it. But yeah, I think that. I mean, just looking at the way in which the film and the actresses were criticized and talked about and made fun of, you know, I mean, I don't think we've learned much of the lessons that we probably should have learned, you know, 25 years ago. I mean, just look at the way that we, you know, the way we critique things and we make fun of celebrities and, you know, just Showgirls was just became a pylon, you know, it was easy target, you know, for a lot of people. And I think that's something that, we're used to doing but just looking at the way in which this film has been embraced. And I mean, it does challenge the idea of, you know, what is good, what is bad, what's a failure, what's a success, you know, because it's been all of those things at one point, you know? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And certainly if you're going to have monkeys in a Las Vegas Showgirls review, make sure they're wearing diapers and don't let them shit on the stage. Yeah.
And don't feed them garlic.
Oh, for gosh all that sakes. Garlic, I swear.
Why is there something like zoological about feeding monkeys garlic?
I have never heard that. I've never heard of that.
I think it's just because the monkey shit smelled so bad, she thought it was garlic, right?
I thought, now we're here, we're debating what was.
I'm not a zoologist.
I was under the understanding that they were eating garlic, but maybe it maybe gave them the shits.
They make babies.
Yeah, they make babies.
Don't bring your children to the backstage when there are people running around naked. Doing lines of cocaine.
I know. The teddy bear.
Mommy! Yeah, I wonder why they even like showed that dancer with her children. I guess it was supposed to sort of like capture the wide range of stories of women's experience. Because, you know, Paul Verhoeven and Joe Esterhaz spent a lot of time, and even the actors themselves, just talking to people in Las Vegas in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of their, Paul wrote about that in his book of essays, you know, he kind of detailed their ventures in Vegas, and they went out there to explore, and they first started with the big, you know, the big casinos, and the managers, and the dancers, and, you know, just everybody that was a part of those shows, because they knew that that's where they wanted to focus the story, but they didn't find anything, you know, what they thought was interesting. They, where they found that was at the seedy strip clubs, the way that they describe. And he talks, you know, he writes about, you know, getting lap dances and, you know, what that was like. And so I think that, you know, there was probably a lot going on that weekend or what,
did,
however
did
long.
Did he admit to like doing a lot of cocaine, just some of the finest cocaine in the world, darling?
You know, he, I don't think that's ever been, you know, he's never commented on that, but yeah, I mean, it, the references are, you know, all over the place in the movie. So,
cause he fucked them without fucking them. Cause people got AIDS and shit. I'm just wondering, like, in the screenwriting of this, Joe Esterhaz, is he like, okay, what other crazy shit? Doggy Chow? Sure, let's throw that in there too.
Well, yeah, it's like where are you getting those references? Are there, is there one crazy dancer that they talk to and like, oh, this is interesting. Like, just keep writing this down. Write this down. It's like,
well, Jeffrey McHale, I wish you nothing but the success of your documentary film, You Don't Know Me. That's available everywhere you can stream or purchase or rent a movie online right now.
Thank you. Yeah.
But interestingly enough, the movie Showgirls can't be found anywhere.
I think you could get the Blu-ray. I thought
you can
Stars or Encore or something. Yeah, it was on Prime, I think, if you upgraded to Stars at one point. But it comes and goes. Like, at one point it was on Netflix and then it wasn't. But yeah, that is... just buy it. Everyone should own it.
I mean, I just don't understand, like, because if you right now want to watch this movie, and people can message us.
<We've found laughs> Where do we watch
it? Illegal link, but definitely buy this movie if you can. There's no way right now. You have to buy a Blu-ray DVD player in order to play the Blu-ray DVD version. Otherwise, you're having to pirate it. And to me, it seems very strange that that Hollywood will sort of make these films available and not available, especially considering that's been such a cult classic. And even in 2005, they, you know, I think it was it 20th Century Fox or MGM that released this film?
MGM.
Yeah. MGM. Say it backwards. Which is a line in the movie. they actually released this with shot glasses and pin the tail on the donkey. Yeah. They were pin the tassels on the stripper posters. The
showgirl, yeah. And then a deck of cards, shot glasses. There was a whole, they had like a Scores kind of lap dancing tutorial on one of the DVD menus. And that was the DVD that David Schmader recorded his commentary for too.
And that was the writer that sort of inspired you and led you to also wanting to, it really influenced you as a filmmaker to making You Don't Know Me.
Yeah. I mean, he was the first one I reached out to. And I mean, yeah, his commentary track is just brilliant.
Yeah. Well, Jeffrey McHale, it's a pleasure chatting with you. I feel like, you know, we're friends. You think you can do my nails for me now, Jeffrey?
On a second thought. Too old for that hoary look.
Damn it. I was supposed
way
to say
too
that.
Old for that hoary look.
You think of like Elizabeth Berkley or Gina Gershon, like people come up to her and then scream, thrust it.
Oh, I'm sure they get all sorts of references and lines and, you know, thrown at them. I mean, Gina said, you know, in one of her Q&As, I mean, the movie that everybody asks me about is Showgirls, you know, Showgirls. So
we got so close to getting Gina Gershon on the show. She released a country Western album of music and she wanted to come on the podcast to talk about it. And we were like, yes, it's okay if we ask her some questions about Showgirls. And they were like, yeah. And then it fizzled, unfortunately. But I feel like at this point, they're kind of like sick and tired of talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to be at that point. 25 years later, it's like, get over it. But we can't. It's so good.
Yeah. You think you can do my nails for me now? Deceased. Must be weird not having them come all over you like that. Different places. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Oh, this is so fun. Thanks, guys.
You're welcome. Take care, my friend.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Jeffrey McHale is from different places.
Places. He lives in places, namely Los Angeles now.
Absolutely. You Don't Know Me is available for rental or streaming online at all platforms. So you can learn more about the film through our website, feastoffun.com, or You Don't Know Me film. Mm-hmm. And it's Know Me is spelled Know Me, M-I.
N-O-M-I.
You Don't Know Me film.com.
I want to remind folks, we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus. Your contribution to the show is what makes this show happen. You can also access thousands of our podcasts, many of which that we talk about Showgirls in. And you can just check out the tag on Showgirls and something will pop up.
Yeah, actually, you go to feastoffun.com/plus, become a member, and you can archive thousands of legendary shows with actors and Peaches Christ talking about the movie Showgirls. Like, one of my favorite ones was All I Really Need to Know I Learned from Watching Showgirls. Mm-hmm. And even a blog entry where Mark talks about, if Showgirls were Star Trek, what the characters would play which role.
If I have totally forgot I wrote that. Fausta pointed out to me, I read it again today. I was like, oh, that is actually pretty, that makes sense. It could use a little updating, but still is fun.
So Nomi Malone would be an Orion slave girl. Mm-hmm. Krista Coloners would play a Klingon. Zach Carey would be a human.
One interview I really enjoyed talking to was Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, Cassandra Peters, because she was a Las Vegas showgirls. And we asked her about, like, is that movie for real? Is that how it goes? And she just, you know, her response was just like, basically, no, it is nothing like Las Vegas that she knew.
Well, and part of it is, you know, Showgirls is an exaggeration. Yeah, yeah. It's a cartoon of this decadent world. But we've been to Las Vegas. And what I thought was really unusual and strange in 2006, 2007 was, and that was a decade after the film had come out, it seemed like nobody in Las Vegas was familiar with the film. Do you remember like that experience, like when we were talking about it with people?
A lot of people didn't see it because it was so panned, you know, and then it was just like, I mean, a straight guy's not going to want to watch that film, right? It's not going to appeal to him. But a gay guy's going to want to watch that film because it is all about Eve and a G-string.
But when, like, I'm from Puerto Rico in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and it's like when people talk about San Juan, Puerto Rico in a movie, like I'm familiar with almost every pop culture reference to Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. from West Side Story to The Flying Nun, which is supposed to take mm-hmm. place in Puerto Rico. I'm always like, oh my God, Puerto Rico's in a movie or a TV show, you know? And even when like the Love Boat, you know, docks in Puerto Rico, you're like, that's Puerto Vallarta. That's not Puerto Rico. You know, so part of me is like, wondering, you know, why the people in Las Vegas have this kind of love-hate relationship, or almost it's like the black sheep of their family. There's something they don't talk about. And, you know, the expression, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, was inspired by this film.
It sure was, wasn't it?
We're going to leave you here with Rena Riffle singing the song Perfectly Imperfect, inspired by her role as Penny Hope in the film Showgirls. Enjoy. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Perfectly imperfect, tripped up on my charms. Perfectly imperfect, wrapped up in your arms. The whole world in the palm of my hand. I wanna see the view from the top. I'll wait right here until skies are clear. Here I stand. Perfectly imperfect. You know the way. Dream.